Good morning. This is Real Estate for Breakfast podcast, and I'm your host, Phil Coover of Shank Annis Tepper Campbell. The Real Estate for Breakfast podcast is a Chicago-centric commercial real estate podcast utilizing attorneys, finance, and real estate professionals to create thoughtful commentary on current real estate issues. This podcast is a mixture of real estate business and law. If listeners are interested in a certain topic, feel free to get in touch with us by contacting us at solutioncenter@satcltd.com or by visiting our website, realestatebreakfast.com. Today, we have Dan McCaffrey of McCaffrey Interests. McCaffrey Interests is a commercial real estate developer. They also manage, broker, and lease properties. And they are a fascinating company. They've been on my radar for years, and I noticed them when I was walking down ICSC, and I saw their enormous model of what they're doing called the Lincoln Common Development in Lincoln Park. But most of you know that as the former Children's Memorial Hospital right there up in the heart of Lincoln Park. And so I wanted to have Dan on to talk about that development and just development in general. And Dan talks a lot about big picture ideas and concepts about development and succeeding in the real estate world. And I thought it was a very interesting discussion. So I know that you will as well. And I just want to thank all of our listeners for writing in and for subscribing and giving us all these great ideas. So please help continue to do that. Help tell your friends. Leave us a rating or review on iTunes. And thank you so much. Before we get into it, I should mention that the podcast is produced by SATC Solution Center, L3C, which is the Education and Development Division of the law firm Shank Annis Tepper Campbell. Shank Annis Tepper Campbell creates business solutions for individuals, entrepreneurs, and privately held companies. We partner with our clients to provide commercial real estate, business, estate planning, litigation, and insurance law guidance to grow their business and protect their assets. Now, we have Dan McCaffrey of McCaffrey Interest. Enjoy. Real Estate for Breakfast podcast. I'm your host, Phil Coover, and I'm here with Dan McCaffrey of McCaffrey Interest. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Dan, thanks for agreeing to do this podcast. I really appreciate you doing it. I'm really excited to learn about some of your projects here in Chicago. But if we could just start, I was looking over your bio this morning, and I was wondering, you went to school in Canada. How did you wind up in Chicago developing over $2 billion worth of properties?
Well, you have no choice. I got married young, and she said I should do it.
That's fair.
I was a school teacher. Well, I've told a lot of people this story, but it's true, and it's kind of neat. Maybe a little bit somewhat inspirational for some. But I was a school teacher, and, was doing rather well kind of young. And got bumped up into administration, and I soon realized I was a school teacher because I really liked the kids. I wasn't so sure I liked the teachers when I became an administrator. I don't mean to say anything bad about teachers, but being an administrator is a lot different than being a teacher. So my wife spotted that and said, you really ought to look around. And she made an introduction to a guy that made an introduction. The guy hired me on a whim to go into real estate. And it turns out the company I joined ended up being one of the biggest companies that exists today, you know, through a couple of mergers.
Sure.
And they own the World Trade Center and all of this kind of stuff. So I split off from them on my own in 1990, but they're the reason I moved from Edmonton to Minneapolis to Chicago, and then in Chicago started my own shop.
And that was about 25 years ago or so?
Well, 27 now.
So your shop does a lot of different things. I was first became aware of your shop through your development that you do. A lot of really large-scale projects. Is that something that you really have a great passion for?
You know, Phil, I'll tell you this. I explain it this way, whether I'm full of baloney or not, I'm not sure. I could be. But I think in the real estate business, when you do something successful, something, You catch the eye of your fellow real estate people, brokers, and so on and so forth. And if you did a duplex, someone's going to come to you and suggest you should do a fourplex. Yeah. And if you do a fourplex, someone's going to say, whoa, you did a great job with that. I've got an apartment building you could do. And if you do an apartment building, next thing you know, someone will come to you and say, listen, I've got a tract of land where you can do 10 apartment buildings. So it's not that we specialize in big projects, but there is no doubt about the fact that we have either allowed ourselves to be seduced into larger projects, or it just the appeal of larger projects has attracted us. But we do some small ones too, but the large ones get all the noise.
Well, that's a great segue into the Lincoln Common. Mm-hmm. It's a very large project for our listeners. It's the old Children's Memorial Hospital in Lincoln Park is the site of it. And so tell us a little bit about that project, but also I'm just curious what attracted you to that project.
Okay, again, not mean to be humorous, I'm just telling the truth. Not much attracted me to it originally.
Really?
I was kind of down on doing it, but I must have been susceptible to the allure of a young woman. The young woman in our office lived there, up in that area.
Yeah.
And beat on me, literally, for weeks, saying, we should do that project, we should do that project, we should do that. So she convinced me, and it did take some convincing to respond to the RFP. And then to my surprise, we won the RFP. So that's how we got into Children's Hospital, and I'm glad we did. I mean, it's obviously a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. But part of my reticence was kind of justified. I mean, we're getting very near 5.5 years.
Yep.
That we've been involved in it, and we've just now broken ground. And I draw that to your attention because the glamour of what looks like big projects, in the time period that it's taken us to get that project going, there are small real estate companies all over the country that might be on their sixth project, you know.
Right.
They can turn them out quicker and a little less stress and a little more. You know, maybe it's easier, maybe it's more fun, but there is no doubt about the fact that we love it. It's going to be a great project, and we are now underway finally.
Yeah. Well, I was just admiring your model. Out yeah. in the front. That's what sparked my interest in doing this podcast with you. As I saw the model out at ICSC.
Oh sure.
Yeah, that's a great way for people to visualize the scale of it. 100,000 square feet of retail, 538 apartment buildings, 40 luxury condos, senior living, parking, and multiple pools, green space. I mean, yeah. It's going to be the crown jewel of that area, I think.
We sure intended that way, because if it's not, shame on us. You know, because when anybody gets an opportunity to have a shot at recreating a 6-acre area within a wonderful community, you know, a community that some would say doesn't need it, others would say yes, it's great, but nonetheless, getting 6 acres contiguous acreage to do a master plan in a very established area, that's quite a challenge and an opportunity.
Right. Well, let's back up a little bit. I was thinking when you said there was an RFP, a request for proposal. Mm-hmm. Who sends that out? Is it the owner of Children's Memorial Hospital? Is it the city that says, somebody please do something with this? No, or who's asking for this to be developed?
It was the hospital.
Okay.
The hospital hired, you know, what was her name before? Anyway, Bob Wislow's company, before Bob's now with CBRE, as you know, but Marty Stern was the representative consultant hired by a Children's Hospital to solicit the proposals, and that's how we got it, when we got it.
So what does your process look like when you have, so you say to yourself, I have 6 acres here of available space, just in broad terms, how do you come up with the vision to generate that sort of thing and to forecast the costs and what you're going to do. And I notice you have a great partner in Heinz that you're working with. And so how do you decide what kind of partners you want to work with on given projects?
Well, first to the vision, you know, the vision is the RFP comes to you and you see the land, and then you have to do a little bit of imagineering.
Mm-hmm.
And as you imagineer, work with a contractor, a good friend, and try to estimate the costs that would be associated with having that dream realized, and then you work backwards to a land price, and you submit your bid based on that, and hope to hell you haven't made too many mistakes. You know? So that's precisely what we did, and in fact, we bid against, or competed against, Heinz, and competed against Related and all the big guys. So it was a matter of some matter of pride for us to have been selected. I think we did a good job. We're told we didn't offer the biggest price. I'm not sure about that. But a compliment that we received was that the hospital board or others, I'm not sure, thought that we were of the character that could be properly received and accepted in the community, that we would do a good job with the community. It was very important to the hospital not to offend the community. So that, and I guess our price and other things, we were chosen. And then we went through the the whole approval process, which is, you know, that's a challenge and a half. But we got through that, and when we got everything approved, or basically approved, then I realized it's a big nut, you know, it's a big chunk to chew at one time. So I have nothing but great respect for the Heinz people. So I approached them and said, would you like to partner? So that's how we've ended up now in a partnership, and they're fabulous people, fabulous companies.
Right, they also have a lot of great projects.
Great projects, super bright.
Well, you were talking about the approval process. Are you referring to the city? Approved.
Yeah.
Now
the city, you know, surprising, people say the city process, you know, give the government its due. The city approved process is fairly black and white, you know, it really is. They have rules and regulations, you follow them. It's, but one of the rules that they have is they basically look at you and say, well, what did the community think about this? And of course that drives you into the living room of every house in
right.
the community, you know. I mean, everyone has an opinion, and the more you ask for their opinion, the more opinions you get. And then every once in a while, you might even ignite a flame, either positive or negative, but you have to deal with both, you know. So that's the community process rather than the city process is what really takes the time.
Yeah, right. Do you find that now that you've done so many projects that it's easier for you to get city approvals? Because you do a lot of work here in Chicago, that also in Pittsburgh, and it was Washington, D.C., and Denver.
Yeah.
Do you find that your first project was harder to get approved by local government, and now that you have such an established track record of successful projects that it's... it's just a little bit easier that you get the benefit of maybe some...
No. The approvals, again, not using the word city, but using the word community, because
right.
the city won't approve you if the community doesn't weigh in somewhat positively at some point. The system doesn't really change. And maybe hearkening back to one of my earlier comments about us, we developers kind of progressing always to do larger and larger and larger. The bigger the project is, the more you're asking for the community to be involved. So you might understand it's coming, but there's no shortcut. And the city can't shortcut. You've got to get approvals.
Right.
Not approvals. They want to know that the alderman signed off, and of course the alderman wants to know that the electorate has signed off. Without the electorate signing off, the alderman's not likely to do it.
Of course. Speaking of getting to be bigger and bigger projects, I noticed in the West Loop you have a project. I think it was 1115. It's West Fulton. It seems to be a little bit smaller than one of your projects. I read somewhere online that indicated that you just. It seemed to indicate that you couldn't resist the fun of the exciting development that's going on in the West Loop.
There's some truth to that. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, and I don't mind telling you, it's kind of fun for me to be able to say, if I didn't have a couple of young people on staff, I may not still know that the West Loop exists.
Right.
You know, it's Millenniumville. You know, it really is.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very exciting space, you know, area. And being beat up here a little bit by the younger team, you know, let's go over to this West Loop. And of course, the numbers and stuff they were throwing around, I couldn't believe it. But, you know, we have one person on staff. We have a lot of people on staff that don't take no for an answer. But one in particular is my son. And, you know, they have the advantage of browbeating you when you get home.
Right.
So
it's nonstop.
Nonstop. Mom, did you know what that... Anyway, it goes on and on. So, fine. I said, go find something. So, you know, wisely, he chose something small that wouldn't crack us over the head. And so we have that, and then we bought another one since. We're still poking around looking for others, I think.
Still exploring that West Loop
side. Yeah, I think it's, you know... certainly when it gets blessed by McDonald's and blessed by Uber and Google and all of these guys, it's not going anywhere. It's not going away.
Right.
And then you can take a lot of peace in, you know, the fact that South of Market in San Francisco and the Meatpacking District in New York and the Strip District in Pittsburgh, which I guess we were the pioneers for that one, the Strip District in Pittsburgh. The millennial... the influence on real estate by the millennials and those who want to court the millennials, it's real. You know, they like to have these real urban areas, but they're not apparently, it would appear, how about that for a qualification? It would appear that they're not seduced by brass and glass. You know, they're more seduced by something that looks somewhat authentic, somewhat real. You know, I commented on the fact that you have a tie on. I hope your audience doesn't mind me saying that. I normally do. I did yesterday.
I'm a conservative lawyer.
Yes, right.
Always show up with the tie.
Yeah, I'm a conservative guy myself. I had a tie on yesterday. But, you know, I get up and down the elevator here, even in the Hancock now, where we have, you know, a lot of PR firms. Jeepers. You know, the world's changed. You know, you go to work and... Any
right.
number of outfits now.
A lot of people in the building with shorts and flip-flops.
Yes, yeah. Shorts and flip-flops, yeah, absolutely. So those areas that are more amenable to shorts and flip-flops in all the cities in the U.S., those areas are growing like crazy. Gaslamp District in San Diego. Downtown L.A. had been abandoned, as most people know, for places like Orange County and so on and so forth. Hell, downtown L.A. now is just alive. But it's alive with the Fulton Market-esque development.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think you're being a little modest. You said you're no spring chicken and you need the help of your young staff. Because I noticed that you've had, when I was looking at your projects, a couple things stood out to me. It seemed to be that there's a lot of them were projects that would be in areas that appeal to the millennial market. You do have a lot of mixed use, a lot of retail as well as residential projects, and they all seem to be near mass transit.
Yeah.
In quality mass transit. Is there a certain theme that you're going for? Do you feel like near mass transit is something that lasts?
You know, honestly, nothing would please me more than be able to say to you that I had a checklist and I won't buy if it's outside the checklist, but it's just not true. I think if to give myself and anyone here in the office credit, I often say we could drive by the next great green field in America. It's ready for massive development. We wouldn't see it. When we drive down, when I drive downtown and a couple of the others, you know, you just can't help but notice something that's either beautiful and run down or in a great spot and there's something open next to it. The one in, there's a project in, that we did in D.C. area, Clarendon, Virginia. It was a recycling center. Mm. Recycling, and all around it were these beautiful homes and all the rest of the stuff. And, you know, the family had owned it for years, and I said, holy mackerel, if you own that, you could do something. That turned out to be a super winner. But it's not particular genius, you know, it's just that we were in an urban area, and then, whoop, here's this big open space. What's it doing?
Yeah.
But I don't see it when I, you know, drive into a suburb so much. I really don't.
Right. I was just so focused on your story right there. I got lost on my questions.
Good storyteller.
So, you know, kind of just furthering that question, what do you look for? Is it urban areas, something that, you know, when you finish the next project, do you always sort of just naturally have something coming on online, or are there times you say, I'm going to go find a project?
Well, the reality is, okay, there's a reality to it. It's not all wishing, by golly. You build a company, and the next thing you know, you've got a hell of a payroll. And it just happens, right? Because you can't do this stuff by yourself. You have to have really talented people around you, hardworking people. And you look, and you're, holy mackerel, we got a payroll to meet. You know, this year, next year, the year after. And so you do get on somewhat of a treadmill. You know, you can't kind of help it, because I don't like to lay people off. I wouldn't, you know, in the troughs and so on and so forth, don't lay people off. So I ask people to work extra hard when things are going well, but we always have, we're always very receptive to hearing about the next deal, because as Children's Hospital would show you, you know, the next deal, you may not get a dime out of it, terms of fees or anything, for 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Right.
So you better have a few things in the pipeline to feed the beast, you know. Because so we're always scouting, you know, we're always scouting around. But it's not, again, it's not as program oriented as you might imagine, because it's just not, you know, if we, again, great thanks to the brokerage community. We get a lot of phone calls. Hey, how about this? How about this? How about this? So you get a lot of those. So it's not like you have to get in the car and go screaming around.
Sure.
People bring you opportunities, you really owe it to yourself and your company to take the time to go look at them.
When you complete a project and you have the development done, do you prefer to hold on to that asset for a time period, or do you prefer to sell it, move on to the next project?
More of that depends on who financed it with you. I would love, I'll tell a funny story. This is a cute story. You know, I bought the old Nike Town site for $23 million from my former company.
Okay.
We put some money into it, and we sold it for $43 million. And I have my little piece of that, because I didn't own the whole thing. I didn't have the $23 million in the first place. But my little piece of that, I got a couple million dollars or $3 million. Wow, I'm on easy street. You know, so 23 to 43. As you'd probably know, it sold last spring, a year ago, for $294 million.
Wow.
So my $43 million, you know, great idea, Dan. Sold for $293. So you asked me, would I like to hold things? Of course. But I couldn't hold them because I quit my job. That was basically my first project. So you need money. Now later on, Clarendon, the one I was telling you about in Virginia, to build it, it's 130 or 110 or something, you have to partner with an institution. With institutions, as you well know, in the real estate business, the people in the institution get paid and bonuses on the basis of IRRs. So, you know, an IRR means ownership is on a stop clock.
Right.
You gotta sell that puppy now. Boom, you get a great IRR. Today, fortunately, a little bit of a reputation, a little bit of a pocketbook, I can start to look at some projects and say, we're going to hold them long term. And so we don't invite in the investor, the institutional investor that wants to turn them over quickly. So it's not so much what I want to do as what it was necessary to do in order to get to a point where you've got a little bit of a brand, and you got a little bit of money in your back pocket, you can decide to hold more stuff. Again, because we got big so fast, the project got big so fast.
Right.
If I'd stayed doing duplexes, I probably could have kept most of them. But I didn't.
When you're looking for a capital partner, what type of capital partner do you prefer to have?
Well, there again, most of them are quite, they're quite obvious, the pension funds and life insurance companies.
Right.
They have a whole bunch of guys that are out looking for me, just like I'm out there looking for them, kind of thing. So after that, I would never play down. For any young person that's listening and think that, there's something to learn, anything to learn in this, relationships. You know, a guy who gives you the best deal may not be the best deal. Just, you better like one another. You're partners. And we've had some rough starts with some folks. I think of myself, doesn't mean they think of me, but I think of myself as a nice fellow,
Good distinction.
Some other guy might think I'm not a nice fellow. But it's best if you can find someone that you think's a nice fellow and who thinks you're a nice fellow. And because the money is not going to make a big difference if there's a fight. If there's a fight, if they don't end up trusting you and you think that they're taking advantage of you, the project's not going to matter much. You're going to end up in hell. So relationships over returns.
I feel that's a good lesson for all sorts of areas of practice. I feel the same way with clients. You should really want to, in the legal world, you really should want to work with people because life is just too short, and it's just so much better if you're working with clients that you really enjoy and appreciate, and if they feel the same way, hopefully, about you.
Yes, that's what you hope.
So, do you see any trends right now in the commercial real estate space? You're doing a lot of mixed use, a lot of retail and residential. Do you see retail curtailing at all?
It's funny. I was just thinking about that. I've been thinking about that for a few weeks now. There's so much bad news about retail. We should all go into retail.
Right. Great point.
If real estate truisms don't completely disintegrate, we should all go into retail. But we should be very careful. Why should you go into retail? What retail will survive and where? So, I'm trying to articulate a description, let's say, call it that, of where we should look for retail. Because if it's a great location, and there's a population around there, and so on and so forth, and not to offend her, although she's not a she, but Ann Taylor, the store, if Ann Taylor goes out, Ann Taylor is probably going out of that center, not because of that center. Ann Taylor's going out because Ann Taylor's gone bad. The company has gone bad. So if it's a really good location and you're surrounded by nice homes, all the rest of that stuff, Ann Taylor goes out, that could be good news.
Sure.
Because the next tenant in probably pays up a wee bit. And the next tenant in is excited to be there. So it puts more energy in the center. So retail is definitely changing. Retail is definitely shrinking. But really good locations are not shrinking. There's still as few of them now as there was before retail started to go bad. One of the fellows said to me, I think I was at ICSC, he said, we're not overstored, we're under demolished. It's sort of a cute thing. There was a rush to build a whole lot of stuff, And a lot of it's on the periphery of the cities. And now you get all the millennials moving downtown and so on and so on. That's going to change the character of a lot of the further out suburbs. And the story of that store closing is going to be in the New York, in Wall Street Journal, saying Ann Taylor stole 10,000, closed 3,000 stores. Well, what if 2,780 of them were in far out suburbs of each city?
Right.
You know, what if? So I think retail, all things being as they've been in the past, it's not a bad place to look right now.
Yeah, your comment about if everyone's saying retail is going south, that we should go to, it kind of reminds me of when, right after the crash in 08, Warren Buffett, a few months later, was buying stocks of everything.
Yeah,
just go the other direction.
But you would do it, like I said, you know, I haven't come up with the definition of what we should go scouting for, but most definitely the character of retail is changing. You know, it's not good enough just to put in a bunch of stores. You know, people want to go to some place where they, it's like restaurants and bars.
Yeah.
Or a better example, ladies' dress shops. Best ladies' dress shop in the city will not survive unless it's got other ladies' dress shops around it. Women don't go to a dress shop to shop. Women want to go where there's seven dress shops close proximity to one another. So
yeah,
they can
convenient.
Look
right.
at different stuff. Compare and contrast, know they're seeing all the options. So I think there's spots where retail will continue to survive quite handily and maybe even exponentially because of all the closings.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
you close a certain percentage, and you know the internet is definitely a player, but I do believe there's going to be an upside to that. You know, a leveling off, where it just grows as normal. Everything else grows, normal.
Sure, I received a magazine just 2 days ago. It's on my desk right now, and the headline is "Retail is FUCK." ED,
yeah.
Which is the front page of, it's okay to say it on the podcast because
yeah.
It's the front of this magazine that came to me. And what I was thinking about is it should say 25% of retail, which is big box and surrounding,
right. In all,
non-urban
all the
areas, is FUCK. But it doesn't make for a good headline.
No,
it doesn't sell a lot of newspapers.
No.
Yeah.
I see that headline used a lot when it comes to the GOP.
Yeah, you do.
I don't believe that either.
So I always like to ask people what is their biggest failure. That's a little bit of a dramatic way to say it, but just do you have a project that you're always like, oh, I wish I had that one back, wish I would have done that differently?
Yeah, there's one that always comes to mind. It's in Minneapolis. And it was, I would give our team a, you know, B+ for a good try. But, you know, easy to deflect blame, and I don't intend to deflect blame. I should have been smarter. But we accepted an extraordinary challenge to build a project in an area that I knew well and that had a history of being bad, area. And, then, you know, my Irish stubbornness got in me. And I said, I've got to make this succeed. I'll make this succeed. But the winds of change in the city weren't there at the time. And in a way, I took on the politicians. I took on, you know, those, the negative sayers, and I should have listened to them both. Well, the politicians were part of the problem. They wanted X. I wanted Y. And so the compromise was Z. But Z was no good. I should have known it.
Right.
And they wouldn't have known it because they're politicians. They wanted to jam something into a site that the site wasn't ready for. And I went along and did a poor job of it. Now, fortunately, my lender and partners, we got out with the skin of my teeth. But I never felt good about the project. You know, I never felt good about it. So that was the worst one. and only real bad one, I think. And that wasn't all that bad. We all got our money out. But it was, it didn't make the difference that I wanted it to make in the city.
Have you still kept your eye on the South Shore project?
Yeah. Yes, I have, yeah.
Okay. What is your favorite building in Chicago? I always like to ask people that. You get a lot of different answers.
Yeah. You know, I think a building, every time I go in and I like to own it, it's that Santa Fe building where Skidmore has their offices. You know, it's an old building. It's beautiful. It looks out on the lake and on the park and all the rest of that stuff. It's gorgeous, but I don't really have a... other than going around to these beautiful old buildings.
I mean, sure.
You know, because you're not going to see them. Well, you might now. The way things are going over in Fulton Market, people may do some extraordinary old buildings. You know, extraordinary looking old buildings.
Right, right.
But
like the CAA buildings. Renovation.
Yeah, that was very...
Very clever very redevelopment.
Daring. Very daring. You know, I tell you what, not afraid to say it, I walked through that doggone thing 5 times, 6 times. I'd go to the front and I'd say, oh, we've got to have this. And then I'd get to the depth of it and the L shape and stuff. Oh my God, it's impossible. These guys did a great job. They did a great job. Hats off. Really tremendous.
It is. It's a beautiful building.
And they've made, you know, they've taken truisms, again, I'll use the word truisms, something can only be so deep and then the back doesn't work anymore. You know, they've taken things like that, and you don't have enough lights and so that, and they threw it all out the window. And they put restaurants back in this and a bowling alley over here and this over there. Amazing. Great. Yeah. Hats off.
Is there something that scares you on a project? I just mean when you're evaluating whether or not to go forward with a project, is there some issue that is always a huge red flag to you? It's a stay away.
Well, the red flags would be an early thing. But during a project, the thing I like to tell myself I'm most concerned with is being careful about the partnership thing. You know, who do you bring in as partner in the financial sense? And, you know, do you feel a partnership with them? Because one thing's for sure, you should expect something to go wrong.
Right.
You're damn lucky if it doesn't, but you should expect something to go wrong, and you really don't want to be in a...
I think it's kind of unique to that industry.
Yeah, well... It is, but maybe what we're both saying is, well, these big, beautiful things are all subject to a very unforgiving marketplace.
Sure.
If things turn against you, you know, you're not God nor a doctor. Neither one. So if the market turns against you, you should have a partner that understands it's the market that's turned against you, not your partner. And you're not going to turn against your partner. Just, you know, I mean, not looking for a pat on the back. One of the project I mentioned to you that went bad, I called up our lender and said, you know what, we're going to stay as engaged as we've ever been managing, but I'm not taking a managing fee. I didn't think we should be getting a management fee while he was struggling to keep his principal in place. He so appreciated that. They've financed 3 projects with us since.
Nice.
Small,
wow.
Small gesture. You think about it.
Right.
It was a few $100,000 a year, but it was a small gesture in comparison to what he had at risk. And I hate to make it sound so mercenary now, but that paid off.
Right.
Paid off both in personality, like in terms of I got a personality, I've got a friend that's... Personal friend, not personal. Personal friend, in a business setting, and he wasn't afraid of stepping up 2 more times. So.
I think that's a great lesson.
Yeah, it was good for me.
What's your favorite project that you've worked on, if you have one?
No, you know, it reminds me when I was a very young guy in the business, and the company I was working for, which is now Brookfield, was buying a whole portfolio of buildings from a family in Toronto. And the guy, our chairman, told the story that when he was in the room for the final signing of the papers and all this, he said, the other guy was so miserable. And he said, look, and here I'm paying him $1 billion for all these buildings in downtown Toronto. The guy's miserable. And our chairman said to him, you know, Mr. So-and-so, are you okay? He says, I'm very sad. These are my stepchildren. And there is a certain amount of that, you know. You fall in love with the damn things.
Right.
You know, and yet, you know, you have to turn them over, sell them, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's not easy. Hate to lose them, but stepchildren.
That's
so
nice.
No favorites.
It's nice that you get to work on something that you grow to appreciate and love so much.
Yeah.
It's a nice way to spend a life, a career.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I do like to ask people if they have any advice for young professionals, whether it's in real estate or otherwise.
I think I've been repetitive on that score already.
You've given us a lot of good nuggets.
I did relationships.
Yeah.
You know, I was asked that by the MBA class in Grass Camp, you know, in Wisconsin.
Okay.
This spring. And my comment there was, because I think it applies, I sort of made a sweeping movement with my arm, and I said, take a look around you and don't forget a single name or a single face, and you'll do great in real estate for the rest of your life. And I bet you, unless you're a complete doofus, you know, I bet you I was right, because that room is full of future leaders in real estate. You know, guys like me, don't even talk to them. Listen to me for a blabber on, but don't get to know me. Get to know guys in real estate somewhere around your age, 5 years older, 10 years older, 10 years younger, and cultivate relationships, because there's going to be a star come out. Someone's going to do well.
Right.
You know, a lot of them are going to do well, and it's good that you know them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So relationships, number one.
Yeah, I can think of a lot of examples of my friends from college.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Dan. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Hope it was an all win.
It was great.
Okay.
Nothing contained in this podcast shall constitute financial, investment, legal, and/or professional advice. No professional relationship of any kind is created between you and the podcast host or guests. You are urged to speak with your financial, investment, or legal advisors before making any investment or legal decisions. Furthermore, the opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the opinions of the SATC Solutions Center, Shank Annis Tepper Campbell, or any of its employees. This podcast is created by the host and guests' individual capacities. All opinions on this podcast are or have been rendered based on specific facts under certain conditions and are subject to certain assumptions and may not and should not be used or relied upon for any other purpose, including but not limited to, for use in or in connection with any investment purposes or legal proceeding.